Hello and welcome to the Microbiome Medics podcast. I'm Dr. Siobhan McCormack.
And I'm Dr. Sheena Fraser, and we're your co-hosts.
We are both GPs and lifestyle medics with a shared passion for microbiome science. And we have spent the last 5 years deep diving into the world of the gut microbiome. We'll be translating the evidence and packaging it into actionable, bite-sized chunks so that you can harness the power of the microbiome to improve your own health and that of your patients.
Just before we start this interview, we'd like to remind our listeners to take a look at the Gut Microbiome for Clinicians course. It's available through bslm.org.uk. It's a comprehensive course on the gut microbiome, which takes you from the basics to the clinical application of this fascinating new area of medicine. This course will empower you to use microbiome science in your daily practice.
Hello, and welcome to the second of two episodes on the gut-brain axis and pain. I am Dr. Siobhan McCormack, and today Dr. Sheena Fraser and I are honoured to be joined by pain management consultant and author, Dr. Deepak Ravindran. Now, I would describe Dr. Deepak as a medic on a mission, and that mission is to communicate the new science of pain to clinicians and patients alike. So Deepak is an NHS consultant in pain medicine. He runs a long COVID service at the Royal Berkshire NHS Foundation Trust. He's a physician researcher with the University of Reading, and he's also author of the best-selling book, The Pain-Free Mindset. Now, I think it's fair to say that Dr. Deepak does not lack ambition. He's got big plans for helping as many people as possible understand and manage pain effectively. So hello, Sheena, and a very warm welcome to you, Deepak.
Thank you so much, Sheena and Siobhan, for having me on the Microbiome Medics. It's a podcast that I love, so it's a great opportunity for me to be on your show as well and talk about my interest and passion to your audience.
Lovely. Thanks so much, Deepak. It's lovely to have you here. Siobhan and I have actually been following you for quite some time, I think, because you've been involved with BSLM, as we have, for a number of years now. And, you know, we've all been attending the conferences for quite some time. And I certainly have really enjoyed listening to all your talks. And, you know, you're normally they're normally very entertaining, especially with George Ampat, who's one of your colleagues and friends, an orthopedic consultant. I have to say, I was really enjoying that last one I went to, which you did a talk on spinal problems with George Ampat and spinal pain. And that was such an eye-opener to me, I have to say. It was really, really interesting. I learned so much from you that day. So I'm really delighted to have you on the podcast and to teach us a little bit more about pain and a little bit more about, you know, your passion into lifestyle medicine and pain management, which I think is so important these days. So I think it would be quite good to start off with learning a little bit more about your career, when you first started taking this alternative approach to pain management and what you inspired to do with this. So to kick off, Deepak, and tell us all about you.
Well, thank you so much once again. So it's been a really long journey for me to be where I am right now and the message that I am trying to get across to everyone about my own understanding of the neuroscience of pain and why I think it matters so much to all of us, all our health and our well-being in terms of how we move forward, especially when we're working in the NHS in the UK, in the constraints that we have. I've been in the UK. I trained in India, and my background is in anesthesia, pain management and critical care. That was my postgraduate specialty that I did in India before I came to the UK in 2003. So I've been here more than 20 years now in the UK. I've kind of gone through the usual training that we have in anesthesia within the Oxford region. And I did my fellowship in pain management in UCL. And I became a consultant in Reading in 2010. So I've been a consultant now for close to 14 years now. And in about the first 3 to 5 years, I came in with all the enthusiasm of a pain specialist consultant. My knowledge of medications was, I thought, very good. I could potentially intervene, and as long as I had a needle, I could pretty much block any nerve plexus in any part of the body. And I thought that should be adequate to give people pain relief. And what I found very rapidly within the first 3-4 years of my NHS practice was that it wasn't. It was helping in about a third of patients. That's about it. We were starting to become aware of the challenges of all the medications, the opioids, the gabapentinoids that I was prescribing, that they were not as safe and awesome as they were meant or put out to be. And it was at that point, around 2014-15, I realized, well, actually, at a crossroads, that most of what I'd learned about pain was really not helping my patients, and it was not getting the outcomes that I thought I should be giving them. Two-thirds of them were coming back despite doing a pain management program, despite having medication trials, despite having injections and surgeries. And that's where I thought, well, what have I not learned? What have I not understood? And what I do need to rethink about the knowledge of pain. And when I started reading up to say, well, how else can I help my patients? I was blown away by the fact that there has been so much research in probably the last 10, 20 years from 1998, when I finished my undergraduate, that none of that has really made it into the clinical space. You know, the evidence around exercise and movement with regards to pain, the evidence around the neuroscience of pain, the evidence around diet and the microbiome and its influence on pain, the evidence of sleep and the bidirectional nature with pain, and the mind-body techniques that have got so much of functional MRI evidence, none of that is something that we learn in medical school. I didn't learn that in my anesthesia education. I barely touched upon it during my pain fellowship. And this was me as a consultant in pain medicine. That was my limitations. And my deep dive for the 3-4 years resulted in me saying, well, actually, I'm talking about this to GPs when I do talks. I'm telling about this to patients on a one-to-one basis. But that just isn't moving the needle. And that's where I thought, well, this needs to be at a much more broader scale, at a more one-to-many. And that's what inspired me to try to write a book, to do some bit of foraying and venturing into social media to get the message out. And I got lucky. I got a few nice, good breaks. I got a management degree, which allowed me to understand how to communicate, how to actually get the message in a more effective manner. And here we are with all of this knowledge, some of it and most of it that I've been able to put into the book. But a lot of it is around reaching out to people like yourself, to various other people, to say there's so much more we can do for chronic pain, a problem that affects 28 million UK citizens. That's apparently 43% of the UK population, if the data is to be believed, and probably more people in chronic pain than all of diabetes, all of stroke, all of heart disease. You put them together, we are dealing with a problem that's such a big challenge to our UK economy, and we are still sticking on old, outdated things like only drugs and only injections. So that's my mission, to see if we can make a dent in that part of the universe.
Well, I want to thank you for that, Deepak, because I think that is so important these days. And Siobhan and I can certainly empathize with you on this, because we're trying to get the message out on microbiome science. And, you know, we're finding that our colleagues don't have this knowledge and haven't been taught it. And there haven't, you know, there hasn't been any formal education on these kind of things. So, you know, we're all trying. You've done courses for BSLM. You've put together courses for BSLM. We've done the same. And I think, you know, we're all on this mission together, which I think is really exciting, but we've all got a long way to go still. What do your colleagues think of you, Deepak? You know, if you're bringing this message to your hospital, because I know what it's like in general practice. You know, a lot of my colleagues raise their eyebrows at me, thinking I'm a bit crazy at times because I'm doing things so differently. What do your colleagues think of you?
I think there is that risk. There is definitely that challenge, and probably the unspoken point there that what I'm talking about feels a bit alien to a lot of my colleagues, especially within the pain physician community and the consultant community itself. But at the same time, everybody is aware that with the commotion and drama that has been wrapped around the opioid discussions and the conversations, everybody is very much aware that they can't really hang their hats on medication. most of the UK and most of the world, the evidence right now for saying interventions will be the bee's knees for everyone. That, again, everybody in the community agrees that interventions are going to help only in a selected few, and we need to do better in finding out who that selected few are and whom interventions can make the difference. But everybody understands that the neuroscience of pain has changed and we need to be doing about it. So in a way, I think some of what I'm saying or starting to say or have been saying strikes a chord with a lot of the people within the consultant and the pain clinician community. So actually, when I wrote my book and it came out, I've had a really good response, not just from the patients. In fact, some of the patients feel that the mindset thing, again, takes it back to it's all in the head. So I've been trying very hard to move against the title and the sometimes confusing part of the title. But a lot of my colleagues, you know, consultant colleagues, GPs, physios, other healthcare professionals have really found it useful to say, okay, here is a lot of the more relevant new information packaged in a way that's useful for the patient to read with possibly some tangible output. So in that sense, the pushback has been a lot less. What has been difficult is actually implementation, because the consultants have the knowledge only of medications and interventions. The physios have the knowledge of the movement-based techniques. The psychologists have the knowledge of the mind-body techniques. Very few pain clinics across the country have access to dietitian or nutrition support at all. So the understanding there is very poor. So it's actually the challenge is, here is the message. How can we implement it all together for the patient rather than the patient having to jump four different hoops to get that information? That, I think, is the challenge. And I feel primary care, with its movement now into group consultations with lifestyle medicine, where all of these principles are already there, that's where I see the exciting opportunity, that maybe where secondary care can struggle to get all the pieces to fall in line, primary care may be in a better position because it's already doing it for other long-term conditions. That, I think, is the hope and opportunity I see with getting the message out and getting acceptance on a broader scale.
Yeah, it's tricky, Deepak. I mean, I agree. There needs to be this joined up thinking now, doesn't there? We need to be considering that all of these domains are indeed related. And if we don't all, you know, use all of that holistic approach, then we might be missing something. You know, somebody who's got a sleep disorder, or, you know, somebody who's got a terrible diet, or, you know, somebody who's very sedentary, you know, all of these things are going to impact upon their gut microbiome, upon their ability to manage their pain. Their pain's going to be much worse. They're going to have more inflammation. So I agree, you know, we have to have that joined up thinking. I personally have struggled to implement group consultations. I went through all the training. I got the training for my surgery, and it came down to the point where we were going to initiate. And unfortunately, we realized we didn't have the staffing for it. And that's because you need admin staff to taken away from their normal duties to run the group consultations for you. And we didn't have access to that. And I find that quite difficult because, you know, we're struggling in general practice to have the resources for these type of interventions. So I wish that it would become a bit more mainstream, the use of group consultations. And I wish we had more access to that. But I think we're struggling the way you are in secondary care to implement these things. So it is really, really tricky. I think we should go back a little bit. Now, I'm not going to talk about your book just yet, Deepak, because Siobhan's going to do that bit, because she's just finished reading your book. So I'm going to just go take us back a little bit to talk about pain itself, because you've mentioned, you know, all these incredible approaches to pain management. But can you just tell the listeners what pain is, what chronic pain is, and really touch on a bit of neuroinflammation, the types of inflammation that you can get, and the triggers for chronic pain as you see them?
Yeah, absolutely. So pain itself, we've got the old definition that has been there from the International Association of Study for Pain. You know, they had their definition in 1979 or 80, and then they updated it in 2020. Broadly, that bit of pain being an emotional and a social component and can be talked of in actual physical damage or potential tissue damage or in terms thereof, you know, that definition broadly hasn't changed much. But what changed in 2020 was them adding six supporting statements, which they felt would be more useful. And for me, I think out of there, the second statement, which is pain and nociception are different phenomena, to me, that I think is the most important of those six statements. And I think that deserves almost a expansion, which I think I hope your listeners will find useful. Now, what we have fundamentally always assumed and been told to assume during our medical training is that when pain comes along, it must be always from a physical structure, and that should make us suspect some kind of a physical problem that ought to be investigated or looked for with a blood test or a scan or an image. By that, we are already predetermining that pain must have a physical root for it. You know, some structure in the body would be accounting for the start in pain. And that pain and nociception is the distinction that the IASP wanted to make. So what we are now saying is that when you have a physical injury, when you have a release of chemicals that come along from arthritic flare, from a rheumatoid arthritis flare, from a fracture, from a surgery, from a heart attack, you have release of chemicals that occur in that area. Those are the nociceptive chemicals, a variety of inflammatory chemicals like substance P and everything that we are aware of. But when those nociceptive chemicals travel along the nociceptive pathways, so they're not pain pathways. Pain pathways is a bad oversimplification and must not be used. It is nociceptive pathways. And these nociceptive signals travel to the spinal cord and then the brain. The brain then acts like a predicting and a processing organ. It's there to receive this nociceptive signal. It's there to compare it to previous experiences, previous history. It asks itself, have I ever received the same nociceptive signal from this area before? It does a whole lot of processing and comparison to different parts of the brain. All of this happens in real microseconds or milliseconds or nanoseconds, call it whatever you will. And if the sum total of that decision by the brain is, I need to protect this organism because this is a new nociceptive signal that could be a threat, then that is the time that it is going to invoke the pain experience. What then it would do is it would give out the instructions through its hormone system, through the neural pathways, through the immune system to bring about a protective response. That pain experience is always a protective mechanism in order to potentially remove threat. And so that is the distinction between pain and nociception. What it leads to saying is that nociception could be interpreted by the brain as, oh yeah, I've had this nociceptive signal before. I didn't need to do anything much about it. I think it's fine. In the context, I'm playing football now. I want to score a goal. So the same signal that comes from a twisted ankle will be viewed differently when the same twisted ankle occurs in the middle of a busy road and you see a bus coming towards you. That is going to be viewed differently. So the nociception, you could say, is the same amount. The signal traveling from a sprained ankle to the brain and spinal cord is the same intensity maybe. But the decision by the brain is one of protection and acceptance of that nociception when you're in a football field versus when you're on a busy road, you need to get to safety, it would take a different set of action. So pain and nociception are different. Nociception does not need to result in a pain experience every time. And that's a very important distinction because that has led now to us saying, well, there are three types of pain. One is the nociceptive pain, where there is signaling coming definitely from an injury, and that is decided by the brain as a definite thing to be protected against. There's neuropathic pain, where the nerve has been cut or there is some nervous system damage due to alcohol, toxins, chemotherapy, drugs, diabetes, Parkinsonism, etc. That, again, must be protected for and managed for. And there can be a third kind of pain wherein there isn't any obvious injury, there isn't any obvious nerve damage, but there can still be a signal of threat coming from somewhere that the brain would say it needs to protect. And that can be a threat from the outside, like social circumstances, can be abuse, can be neglect, can be loneliness, or it can actually be from inside. And this is where I think the microbiome, the immune changes, all of that is the internal interoception that the brain can say, yep, this needs protection as well made. This is alien to me. This is not safe and I need to protect. And that kind of pain is what's called nociplastic pain, where the nervous system has become plastic and adapted to become more sensitive rather than actual damage or chemicals.
Oh, right. That's really, really interesting. And actually, when you were talking about the nociceptors, that brought up, I was reading a paper recently, and it was talking about Mycobacterium tuberculosis and how that bacteria stimulates the nociceptors to produce cough. And so the end result isn't pain in that circumstances. The end result is cough, which again proves that nociceptors aren't always just all about pain. So interesting. So if we go back to this nociplastic pain that you're talking about, that's kind of what I was thinking of in terms of the chronic inflammatory, or would that be separate to inflammatory, chronic inflammatory pain? Would that be a separate one to sort of an arthritic pain? You know, is that where you don't necessarily see that there is some inflammation there?
Yes, no. So I would be, now this is still evolving research. And if you look at the academic community, they are still trying to take apart where is it nociplastic and not. My clinical pragmatic view of how I should be applying this in the clinical space to help patients is to first of all say that when you have these kind of chronic inflammatory conditions, rheumatoid arthritis, osteoarthritic flares, or for that matter, conditions like fibromyalgia, irritable bowel, we are having these conditions where there is certainly release of low-grade metabolites or neurotransmitters or inflammatory molecules that act on certain receptors that arouse the nociceptive pathway. There isn't any damage. There isn't any obvious swelling or inflammation that you would find in a nociceptive fracture or surgery. But there is certainly the release of these chemicals, and they are causing the receptors to get excited and start the onset of nociceptive signals. And you rightly said, it doesn't, everything nociceptive doesn't mean painful. The brain will decide what kind of a response it needs to do to protect. It can be a cough, it can be an itch, it can be a discomfort, can be a sort of bloating sensation if it is in the tummy, or it can be a kind of heaviness that it feels in the legs or in the pelvic area. But that decision is an opinion of the brain as a way of threat protection. But the signal is from a chronic inflammatory condition when you don't have a blood test that obviously says high elevated CRP or high elevated ESR. We shouldn't disregard that, oh yeah, you're not having. And that's the challenge I find with, for example, some rheumatologists would say, oh, you don't have any inflammation, your rheumatoid arthritis is stable. But that makes the patient feel like, why am I then struggling with all this pain? And I'm trying to say, well, it is that the pain is very real. Your nociceptive pathways have been activated. The signals are genuine. Your spinal cord and your brain is reacting in the right way to protect you. The question we need to ask is, well, what else could be activating the nervous system and the immune system to be sensitized? and let's work on those things, because at least the X-ray and the rheumatologists have confirmed that the actual joint isn't the problem. And now, actually, Sheena, the studies are there to say that even, and this is work from researchers like Tasha Stanton in Australia and Lorimer and all of these, where they say that even in osteoarthritis and autoimmune arthritic conditions like rheumatoid or ankylosing spondylitis psoriatic, more than 30 to 50% of the chronic pain is happening because of this phenomenon called central sensitization in the spinal cord and in the brain, rather than anything happening in the psoriatic or the rheumatoid joint in itself. The joint may look fairly normal or advanced for that condition, but the changes in central sensitization happens in the spinal cord and the brain.
So it's really interesting, isn't it? And we know that patients with chronic pain have elevated levels of LPS, which is a very pro-inflammatory protein that goes into the bloodstream from leaky gut, from gram-negative bacteria. And that has been found to be much higher in patients with chronic pain. Siobhan and I were talking about this in the last podcast, where we were talking about the role that all these bacteria in the gut play in terms of releasing neurochemicals and neurotransmitters, but also in dampening down gram-negative bacteria so that you don't get high levels of LPS. But of course, a dysbiotic gut can increase that. And that gives you a sort of low-grade level of inflammation, which can then, you know, rocket around your body, creating inflammation in these faraway places. And that can even feed up to the brain and cause inflammation within the brain and around the microglia and the astrocytes. And so I find this really interesting because, of course, there isn't, I mean, you can actually measure LPS, but it's not part of our standard battery of tests. And yet it's a very good measure of leaky gut. And it's also, you know, it's one that the scientists would use as a measure of leaky gut. And it can give you an idea that there is a low-grade inflammatory process going on in an individual with chronic pain, but it's not something that we have access to, or certainly I don't in general practice. I don't know if you have it in secondary care, but that, you know, you're not going to see a rise in CRP or ESR with these individuals, are you?
No, and I think that part is coming. Like, for example, with long COVID, now I've realized, and one of the studies I'm involved with, because in long COVID, for example, in our initial epidemiological study in our clinic, we found that 75% of patients with long COVID also had chronic pain, or at least were now complaining of pain that was lots of aches and pains in many joints, but actually significant pain with pins and needles, tingling, a variety of neuropathic sounding sensations from different parts of the body, headache, tinnitus, all of these things. And so the study that we are now doing and got some funding for essentially takes these patients into an fMRI scanner to actually say, is there evidence of some kind of activation in the various circuits and centers that process for nociceptive signals in the brain. So the usual circuits that process pain signals. And at the same time, we've also done a blood test, which we are sending off to Canada, which is going to give us an idea into the levels of up to 50 mediators, you know, various interleukins and cytokines that have been shown to be elevated in central sensitization. Because that's the operating theory, that it is likely that the pain that comes in conditions like long COVID, in other autoimmune conditions, may not be due to actual tissue damage, but it may be due to this low-grade release of variety of interleukins and cytokines that are then activating various receptors. You know, for example, in the microbiome as well, you're absolutely right with the increase in stress, the increase in a variety of stressful events, or for that matter, illness. We know it increases intestinal permeability and promotes dysbiosis. There was this talk that actually there's something called the protease activated receptors, the PAR2 receptors, and it is that activation of those receptors that drives a lot of the visceral pain that comes through in these conditions like IBS. And so they are saying, well, a lot of the interest in modifying the microbiome to relieve some pain in IBS or modulating the gut microbiome is about trying to change these and improve the number of chemicals that would potentially dampen these receptor activation that comes from these gut here and the LPS that you talked about. So I see so much potential in attempting to modulate the microbiome to help in many conditions of chronic pain, even though I agree with you and I probably reckon our evidence shows that the quality of evidence is not awesome, but I think the direction of travel definitely points to microbiome modification.
Yeah, and when you're talking interleukins, so for our listeners, if you haven't heard of interleukins, interleukins are a big part of the immune system, and there are lots of different interleukins, and some are very pro-inflammatory, so they create inflammation in our body, whilst others can dampen down inflammation and be anti-inflammatory. And so you've got various interleukins that are actually produced by short-chain fatty acids that are again produced through the gut microbiome. So interleukins, like I think it's interleukin 10, is very anti-inflammatory.
Anti-inflammatory, yeah.
And
six
that's
is pro.
By, yep, so butyrate helps to produce interleukin 10. And again, that can really dampen down inflammation anywhere in the body, really. And interleukin, is interleukin 6 is very pro-inflammatory, or have I got that wrong?
Yeah, no, 6 is right, you're right.
Yeah, and that's a very pro-inflammatory interleukin. Again, not produced by the short-chain fatty acids because they tend to dampen inflammation, but in quite a pro-inflammatory state where you've got dysbiosis of the gut, you would almost certainly have higher levels of interleukin 6. So these things are all, again, very linked to the gut microbiome. And again, you know, increasing the amount of short-chain fatty acid production that you have in the gut can actually lower inflammation through production of interleukins and other anti-inflammatory chemicals. So yeah, it's very interesting, and that will have a far-reaching effect. And we know that it does affect the microglia and the astrocytes within the brain as well.
In connection, Sheena, probably the one thing that I would add here as well is, for a long time, again, chronic pain, the way we approached it and the way we even now do it is all about thinking, oh, pain means it's a nerve issue because it's nerves that are not taking the signals. And the reason for giving a nerve block, the reason for giving a nerve modifying drug like gabapentinoids or the antidepressant group of drugs like amitriptyline is, oh yeah, it's all to do with the nerves and dampen the nerves. But what we now know is that when your pain gets chronic, there is a deep connection and combination and contribution from the immune system. And that's what we realize now, is that every chronic pain, we need to think about it as a neuroimmune event, which means on one way, it gets complex because now it's not just about the nervous system, but also the role of the immune system. But in another way, it's exciting to me because that means you now have two different ways to tackle it. If you cannot dampen the nervous system with the drugs that we have at our disposal, you could potentially try to dampen the immune system, and that could make a difference. And it doesn't mean you have to go for fancy immune suppressant drugs, but that's where diet and modification of the microbiome can be a very powerful way to regulate the immune system. Because the way I explain it now to my juniors and to my colleagues is, we think of the nerve signals of, for example, pain traveling along the nerve. It jumps from one nerve to another nerve across the synapse, and then it goes into the brain where you've got lots more synapses and the signal keeps jumping and activating a pain response or whatever. But imagine that at each synapse now, you have got a representative of the immune system, which is the microglia in the brain. And it is actually like a traffic policeman. Now, that analogy doesn't really work in modern day Britain because we don't have traffic policemen there. But in most developing countries and probably in a lot of other places, the concept of actually having a policeman at junctions to moderate traffic, to look after the traffic, to allow for signaling and direction of traffic to flow from one road to the other is a very common feature, actually. And it meant that if this immune cell is the traffic policeman, then the immune cell can sometimes go rogue and direct traffic the wrong way. So a lot of synaptic dysregulation and a synaptic drama that happens in each of the synapses. And if you think that our memory is stored in synapses, if new synaptic connections is how we learn things, if how we remember things, of how habits are formed, then the immune cell is a very, very important player. And to be able to reassure the immune system that it's safe is a very important aspect. And the microglia do a powerfully and very important role in moderating traffic, and they have a big role in chronic pain. So I think anything that modulates the microglia can be a big help for managing chronic pain. And that's where I think the role of diet comes in for pain. But it also means all of these fancy new drugs that are being looked at, like cannabinoids, like psychedelics, like some other forms of other new pharmacological agents, everything is being looked at to saying this could be a potential microglial modulator. So everybody is approaching the nervous and immune system with a lot more respect now because they've realized that's a target for pain management.
Yeah, fascinating. Okay, all right. Well, let's take a slightly different direction now, because that's all the heavy kind of science stuff done. let's talk about how
we geek out a lot, haven't you?
Because it took me a long time to read up on all of this stuff and really kind of get my head wrapped around it. Let's talk about your clinics and how you run your clinics, because I think this is really interesting for anybody working in the NHS now. How your approach is and how that differs really to other pain consultants or other secondary care clinics. So tell us a little bit more about what you're doing.
So with all this knowledge in the back of my mind, the realization is that I'm still in a clinic and in a hospital system where patients would not have heard all of this stuff. So I've got to realize and first of all, find out how much is the patient ready for and what are they expecting when they come to a pain clinic, because their expectations would have already been created by the primary care doctor or the secondary care doctor referring them to the pain clinic. So a lot of times my pain clinic appointments initially start with saying, well, what is it that you're hoping for from today's consultation? And I try to find out where they are at. What is their expectation? I do have a lot of help in the sense that before they come to the clinic in my NHS setup and my private setup, I do send them out a questionnaire, which I ask them to fill out. The NHS one has also got questionnaires looking into their mood, into their anxiety, and into something that I am very interested on from the trauma perspective of adverse childhood experiences. So I have an idea whether the person that I'm going to support with this afternoon, this morning in a clinic, are they having a nervous and immune system that's already vulnerable and sensitized? Or are they in a different place where they have a much better idea of self-efficacy and they know what they want from me in terms of managing themselves and managing their pain? And based on that, my consultations can take one or of either route. One, if they are very clear on what they want and they want a medication or an injection, or they just want help with support regarding either a diet option or a mind-body technique, then my job becomes a bit easier. And I say, this is what is available. These are the resources. Here, off you go. And I can support you with this. The challenge comes when I've got a patient who has got pain. It's widespread pain and they don't know what to do about it. And they feel hopeless because everything they've tried up to then hasn't helped. And that is where often I use, obviously in my clinic, I use a lot of techniques around motivational interviewing, around behavior change, to actually say, what is the smallest thing that they can do, are willing to do, feel confident enough to do, and set up there. And in that range, if they often say, and they often say that, they have tried medications and they don't want to go down the route of medications because they are unhappy with it or it hasn't worked. If their pain is more widespread, then interventions are not really an option at all. And that is where I tend to actually say, well, could your pain, if you let me tell you, could I tell you about why you think you're having this pain? I bring upon the sensitization of the nervous and immune system as a possible reason. I try to get the rapport to say, look, Could this be an explanation that aligns with the way you think about your pain? And if I get rapport and I get alignment there and they say they can see why it helps, that's where I then can bring in the tangible elements of, could a dietary strategy help? This can be anti-inflammatory, here it is. Could a sleep strategy help? And this is what to do. Could you look at some mind-body techniques? And this is what I can do. And I can refer you to my physio or psychologist who does a pain management program. Do you want some digital resources if that's easier for you to access and you like it? If you're digitally naive or you don't like it, then I have some offline and face-to-face options. So thankfully, in my local area, because I help set up the community pain service as well, I do have a variety of options and colleagues who are able to bring this approach together. What I've lacked often is having somebody with regarding the nutrition and dietary side. That's where I have to give a little bit of the information myself. But nowadays, again, there are good resources that I can signpost patients to. But I think a lot of what happens in the clinic at my setup is, first of all, is in understanding where they are and actually what they would like from this consultation and what's the first simple, easy step that they are prepared to do.
Yeah, it's a very holistic approach. And, you know, I love the fact that you're bringing in all the sort of pillars of lifestyle medicine there and utilizing, you know, all of these within your clinic setting. It is disappointing, I have to say, that, you know, there's not more understanding of the role of the microbiome in pain. And as such, you know, the sort of nutritional and dietetic advice isn't there yet. What sort of advice are you giving on the nutrition front?
So literally what I try to focus on with the patients is just to say, look, as far as chronic pain is concerned, we have got a fair amount of evidence to say that if you can reduce some of the obvious pro-inflammatory foodstuffs, which is ultra-processed foods or processed drinks, and I signpost them to a couple of resources that kind of indicate how much sugars are there in the foodstuffs they eat, that at least is a starting point. Can you reduce some of your pro-inflammatory stuff? And then I suggest the anti-inflammatory, you know, some of the fruits and a little bit more whole food, a plant-based, predominantly plant-based. But a lot of patients will say, I already eat enough fruits and veggies, you know, so I do. So my assumption is, okay, if you feel you're having enough anti-inflammatory, can you make a difference in reducing some of the pro-inflammatory? Can you at least improve your hydration to take it up to 1.5-2 liters there? And can you think about just bringing your food intake between some kind of a time restriction? Can you just give a few more hours to your gut to do a bit of MOT for themselves and support there? And I tried to see which of these four things or five things can you at least take on board and ask them to add in a little bit of prebiotics if they can, some fermented foods, can they add in a little bit more of that kind? And as long as I can make it tangible, some kind of tangible thing that they can do, some type of simple thing that they can add in, that is probably my starter for nutrition. And then I refer them to a couple of online resources if they can be ready to have or do that. That's the basic what I'm doing right now in there. I have one physio who is trained and has done some work on nutrition. So when she does the pain management program, she does a whole session on some diets and some recipe options and things like that. But that's where we are keeping it at this point.
Brilliant. Okay. Well, that, yeah, I mean, quite similar to what I'm doing in general practice, really, you know, getting the processed foods out, especially the ultra processed foods, and then increasing the more fibrous foods in the diet. And actually, I have to say, most patients will tell me they eat loads of fruit and veg, but when I do a food diary on them, they're not eating much in the way of fruit and veg. You know, it's quite normal for people to have maybe one, maybe two portions of fruit and veg a day, from what I'm seeing as an average out there. And that's nowhere near the amount of fiber that I want people to be eating in order to really encourage a healthy microbiome.
To a certain extent, I think, Sheena, that's part of what my bigger raison d'etre is, actually, to say I'm maybe the first person to say it, But what we know from behavior change and from a lot of the marketing that a lot of the big commercial organizations do is that they've got a general trend to say that for somebody to change their mind and make a decision to do something differently, it takes an average of 7 touch points to 11 touch points and probably about 6 to 11 hours of content in that sphere before they are willing to change or consider. So what I'd like to say is that if the message that I'm giving, if we can reach a point wherein the patient hears it from 5 or 6 or 7 other people, then if I can be the 7th or the 8th person for at whom the penny drops, or I may be the first person who actually sows the seed, it has actually in some ways, I think that's how I feel the system should change that there.
Yeah.
But another way, it actually takes out the pressure from me, I feel. I am not feeling pressurized by saying, why are they not listening to me? Because it makes me feel comfortable in the fact that, you know what, if I've said it and they've taken it through 1 year and let it out, I'm probably the first person to sow the seed. But someone who gets excited when I say it, I'm probably the 7th or 8th person to say it. So the penny drops and they're ready to take action. So I'm actually less worried these days about not getting immediate compliance / adherence / engagement. Call it what you will, depending on the word that you want.
Yeah. And that's obviously important information for any clinician listening to us today, because that shows us that these little brief interventions that we do for patients actually might have a bit of an influence, maybe not immediately, maybe not there and then, but, you know, a few trips down the line, you know, if they keep getting the same sort of messaging from each clinician that they come across, behavior change will happen. And certainly that's what I'm seeing in my practice, you know, with I teach my trainees to give the same sort of lifestyle advice that I'm giving. And even my partners have got much more into lifestyle interventions nowadays as well. And we're now seeing a lot more patients willing to change. So I think, you know, you're right. A few more hits there. It's going to encourage people eventually along the way, isn't it? Just on the nutrition side, what about probiotics? Do you ever recommend probiotics for pain?
Yes. In fact, in the clinic, Sheena, most of them who are interested in diet, who want to take it up next step, they'll always ask this point. And I must say, in preparation for this podcast as well, I think when I was doing the writing of the book, my editor felt that the evidence base wasn't good enough for me to put anything on paper that they would have to be challenged against. So I didn't put anything there. But I did a bit of a deep dive in the last 2-3 years to see what else has come up. And there are a few good systematic reviews of work from Italy. But I think where we are right now, the TLDR of all of this, is that we still don't have the data in terms of chronic pain to say which probiotic, what quantity of probiotics, what frequency, what dosage. That hasn't been clarified as yet. So that's the big TLDR. But diving a bit deeper, there was a very good study which I saw from 2022 where they had looked at almost 20 years of studies that have been done looking at nutrition, chronic pain, and gut microbiota. And they had about 1,500 articles, but only 122 of them actually looked at the nutrition and pain. And they couldn't come to any firm conclusions because that really isn't an active focus of research. Only less than 2% of the collaborators actually talk to each other. Most of this research is from US, China, and Italy. So there's really nothing that's contextual. And we know that with nutrition, there's so much of cultural context and congruence we need if we want to put something in place for our patients that we see. So I'm afraid that in that light of all that, we couldn't get any clear data on there. I would probably say that, yes, there are some studies now looking at 8 strain. Apparently, they managed to get a big 8 probiotic strains combined together, and they've given it for patients with IBS. But that is just one study, and it predominantly has, I think, Limassol, Lactobacillus reuteri. That's the probiotic, that's the organism that they had. But again, how much do you need? How big a dose that you need? How often to do to relieve IBS patients' symptoms very well? That really wasn't established. I think we need more studies there. At a clinical level right now, what I'm saying, patients, is that there's a second part here that I'm aware of, is that a lot of what gets produced as probiotics, which are the bacteria that can be commercially synthesized in factories, are often aerobic bacteria, which means that they do produce, they do some good. They might be increasing the amount of GABA chemicals and metabolites in the intestine, so it's probably good. But it may not be representative of the actual microbiome that we want to replace in the large intestine, which are predominantly anaerobic organisms. And that really is difficult to commercially make right now because we don't have the technology to do that. So with those two caveats in mind, I say, well, try the probiotics if it helps, but please don't forget to take some prebiotics. Use some fermented foods to ensure that you are having enough feeding of the gut bacteria further down in the large intestine. And that combination may be a better option. Trial it, but I can't say that it's going to definitely help for pain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think microbiome medics, Shiv and I, we'd probably have a similar viewpoint. You know, we sort of see probiotics, prebiotics, symbiotics, postbiotics, all these wonderful biotics that are available. We see them as drugs, essentially, and they're being, you know, we're being produced by pharmaceutical companies, and they're being produced in sort of tablet form, liquid form, all these different varieties, and the quantities of bacteria within them will vary quite dramatically. And so, you know, some of these sound wonderful, you know, millions of units, millions of CFUs, but in fact, when you compare to fermented foods, fermented foods can often have hundreds of billions of CFUs of bacteria. So we'll often have a greater proportion, but, you know, people don't realize just how much bacteria they're getting within their yogurts and their kefirs and their sauerkrauts and all these lovely fermented foods. And the eight strains sounds amazing. You know, imagine eight strains in something. And yet, you know, your kefir, even a supermarket kefir can contain up to 15 strains. Of yeah. bacteria and fungi. If you make it yourself, it can contain up to 40 different strains, which is quite impressive. And certainly, a kimchi or a sauerkraut can contain even more strains than that.
Just loving this conversation. I just wanted to say about probiotics, just because I think it's important when we have conversations about the gut microbiome and, you know, modification, it goes straight from the science of the gut microbiome straight onto probiotics. And then we have this conversation saying, well, probiotics, the research is very flimsy at the moment. And then the conversation about the gut microbiome in today's medicine kind of disappears. But I suppose it's very important that it's a kind of systems approach, that the most important things for your gut microbiome are these lifestyle medicine things. The most important thing is your nutrition. And we can get, you know, these broad advice that you've been given, Deepak, about, you know, increasing your fiber and fermented foods and reducing ultra-processed foods and emulsifiers and sweeteners. All those things are really good for the composition of your gut microbiome. So there's so much we can do. And these other things, whether they're medications or probiotics or symbiotics, are things to fine-tune. But we have to have the fertile soil for any of these other remedies to work. So we really got to concentrate on these, you know, really important lifestyle medicine approaches.
I completely agree, Shivana. That's a very important point. And I think probably it's part of what I try to tell the patients as well, is imagine that, and this is where I try to bring that whole analogy of, you know, when I say about the book and the mindset and the fact that the title puts patients off, I try to tell them, actually, no, the mindset was supposed to be an acronym. It effectively is, imagine sort of a pie chart, and you've got seven parts. You've got the M, the I, the N, D, S, E, and T. And the M is the medications. The I is the interventions. The N is the neuroscience and understanding stress. D is diet. S is sleep. E is exercise and movement. And T is therapies of mind and body. Why are we just saying that everything needs to be, give me the right drug or give me the right intervention? Yes, that's one out of seven or two out of seven. But if you can bring in the remaining five elements as well, then that is going to be a comprehensive strategy to reduce or overcome your pain rather than getting stuck on just one or two of things. And I think the same works with probiotics. Exactly as you said, if it's a drug, if we think of it as a drug, that just forms one of the M. What about the other five strategies which we should be actively pursuing or supporting for all our patients?
No, absolutely. Because if you're getting small gains from all these things, and often I say to patients, you might be talking about, you know, 4%, 5%, 6%. But if you add all those things together, that is, you know, altogether, the response can be huge. And yet, if you just do one thing, you just take a probiotic, or you just slightly increase your fruit, you might not notice a big difference. But if you really focus on, you know, physical activity and sleep, and your nutrition and your, you know, connectivity and reducing your social isolation, that's when the magic happens.
Amen.
Siobhan, you were going to take over now because I think you've got some questions for you back.
I am loving this. I'm a listener on this podcast now. I'm not interviewing at all. Honestly, I've so enjoyed that, and not just enjoyed it, I have learned so much. And the listeners, that might surprise listeners because they'll think, well, you know, I thought she was an NHS GP and she's been a GP for over 30 years. She says, why doesn't she know this? But I, listener, am on a journey with you. This is really new science. And, you know, this is why we all need to learn this together. And I love the idea. Instead, I'd love to clone you, Deepak, but there's only one of you. And this one-to-one, I love this idea of one-to-many. And I've just finished reading your book and it's absolutely brilliant. It's brilliant for doctors, physios, all healthcare professionals, as well as people with chronic pain. And don't forget, we are, you know, physios and doctors and nurses, we get chronic pain as well. So this is for all of us. It's absolutely brilliant the way you communicate it, particularly with this intersection of the neuroscience and case histories. I found it incredibly engaging. I learned so much. I'm going to have to read it many more times. There was one case history that I wonder if you wouldn't mind explaining to the listeners about, that construction worker who suffered an accident resulting in agonizing pain. Could you recount it for the listeners?
Absolutely. It was something that got published as a case report in the British Medical Journal back in 1995. But this was a report that where they identified these builders. And I have to tell you, builders actually contribute a lot to the pain neuroscience literature. They've done quite a lot. But this builder in question, he was working at a construction site, decided to jump from, I think, a 3 or 4 meter platform and jumped right onto a 6-inch nail that went right through his boot. At the construction site, he was absolutely beside himself. He could not be consoled. He was writhing about an agony. They could not do anything for him at the construction site. The ambulance that was called could not do anything for him with gas and air. Nothing was possible there. So they had to wheel off. This was in the UK, mind you. So they had to wheel him off to the closest DGH emergency, accident emergency department. And even in A&E, they could not do anything about this whole big nail sticking out in his boot. And they said, well, you know what? We need to take him to theaters. We need to give him a general anesthesia. The surgeon all got prepped. The anesthetist was there to give him a full-on general anesthetic. And once that was done, they decided the surgeons would get to place there. The nurse took off the boot. The nail was pulled out and the surgeons all got ready to clean the physical wound. And when they removed the boot and the sock, what did they find? No sign of physical injury at all. No blood, no damage to the foot at any point. And the only logical explanation was the nail had gone between the big toe and the second toe. And so there was no physical thing to do at all. Now, to me, this case study illustrates the challenge and probably the beautiful representation of what I talked about earlier, the distinction between nociception and pain. Now, nobody would deny looking at that visual image of a nail poking through the boot, and the pictures there in that study and the article there, that that patient was making this pain up. It was a nail sticking through the boot. He was seeing it and he was writhing in agony. But how do you explain this? The pain neuroscience makes it more easier to explain that when the visual system of the builder saw this nail there, that information went through to the brain. And the brain said, well, whoa, that nail sticking through there is going to be highly threatening, is going to mean that I have to bring about the experience of pain because this needs protection. And that would have brought about the experience of pain. Was there any physical injury at all? Absolutely not. There was no physical injury of count. And for the members of the public who saw that picture, nobody would deny that the builder was actually making up the pain. After all, there was a nail sticking through the boot. But that, to me, clearly illustrates that when it comes to pain neuroscience, the brain works like a protector and is looking out for you all the time to protect you. Is it going to be accurate with this story? Clearly not. It's not accurate, but it would rather take the chance of being overprotective rather than actually making a mistake and not doing anything.
No, that's incredible. And obviously it works the other way as well when you hear about people with war injuries who carry on fighting or Olympians who carry on running despite having major injuries to their legs. So I guess that's almost the other way.
It is. And in that sense, the same picture there of a soldier who has got his leg blown off but still continues fighting, we used to say, oh, he's got a high pain threshold, or that the war is going to, you know, he was filled with adrenaline of the movement, so he didn't feel pain. But a more scientific neuroscience explanation would be that, again, if you're on a football pitch and you scored a goal, or you know, somebody runs with a fractured fibula like they did in the Olympics a few, you know, a couple of decades ago, or in the case of the soldier who's got a leg blown off but continues to fight, a neuroscience way to say would be that the brain has made a decision at that point of time that the bigger risk to life is going to come if the soldier stays on the battlefield with a blown off leg. It's probably better to reduce the pain signaling experience so that the soldier can get himself to safety, after which the brain can then decide which is the next part of pain experience to focus on. And the same would apply to the person on a football field, where I explained that if the brain decides this is a safe event, or the need to achieve the goal is more important, then the dampening of the nociceptive input can happen from the brain rather than the signal overwhelming the response. That's the way probably to look at the alternative opposite sequence as well.
Yeah, that's really, really interesting. One thing I wanted to ask was, I suppose it goes on to this idea, I worry about patients thinking I'm saying it's all in their head, and our use of language is very important. And also they can feel criticized because they're on medications and we're trying to de-prescribe things like opioids. How do we, you're brilliant at communicating these things. Have you got any tips for us as GPs about how we can do this in a really sensitive and evidence-based manner?
No, it's a very important question, Siobhan, and it's something that I take great pains to test out with a lot of patients and colleagues as well, to see how it lands and how it is. Because it is a very, we are saying that the decision maker is the brain, but we want to be very mindful of saying that they are not making it up. And where I feel the explanation could work the most, or most ideally, is in getting that rapport in the beginning, that you are not out there to reduce their drugs or just to fob them off. So that's why I think the beginning of the consultation, where you establish rapport, where you are able to sympathize with their situation, is a big way forward. Because when you then present to them this particular explanation that they are not making it up, that the pain is very real, but it is because of an oversensitive, overprotective nervous system that is out to look after them, that then goes down well. I must say that it is something that even now, sometimes I have patients where I gently approach this and they'll say, oh, so you're another person who's telling me, like the previous physio or like the previous healthcare professional, that I'm making it up. And I have to say, no, I'm not saying that you're making it up. But what I'm trying to tell you is that you have a blood test that's not showing any signs of inflammation. You do have X-rays and scans that don't show any fracture or arthritis or worsening of it. So the question is, if you're still feeling that much intensity of pain and there isn't the necessary scans or blood tests to say that it is accounting for your pain, I'm just offering you another possible reason as to why your nervous system is sensitized. And it could be that it is feeling overprotective. So can you tell me what could be making it oversensitive? You know, have you had any infection? Have you had any added stress? Have you had any change in diet? Have you had any other traumatic event happening to you? Because all of this is going to be considered by your nervous system as threat. And then our treatment strategies can be about how we dampen down those threat mechanisms. And that will mean a reduction in pain. So that's the way I sort of approach it, trying to keep it in the semi-biological state of an activated nervous and immune system. Because in my head, it feels like I'm still in the vague biology bit, which they could accept, rather than them hearing it from someone who says, this is a psychological stressful thing, because somehow they will push back against it. So that's the way I approach that conversation. And that's the suggestion I give to a lot of healthcare professionals is first rapport, then testing out a way of using an oversensitive nervous or an overprotective mom, or analogy could be an overprotective relative who is looking out for them. And that's where I try to approach this whole aspect from.
Well, that's incredibly useful, and language is so important. We use things like slip disc and torn cartilage, and we know it's really difficult when you've used it for years trying to change the way that you describe things and the way you communicate. But just in the same area, Deepak, you talk a lot in your book about trauma-informed approaches to pain. Can you explain what you mean by that?
So to me, this is like one of those foundational elements. And if I had to describe myself, I'd say I'm a trauma-informed upstreamist. So that's the way I sort of talk about it, in a sense that a lot of what we do in a hospital setting is very downstream. We are looking at something and saying cause equals effect in a clinic setting. And then we don't know what to do with the information when the scans and the medications don't work. We then have to backtrack and start a new narrative, which doesn't align with the patient. And then that causes dissonance, which they then don't take up on board. So to me, trauma-informed then actually comes from the perspective of saying, it's not about why people are like that. It's about saying, well, what could have happened to this nervous and immune system for it to be sitting in front of me with this one aspect of the problem? So therefore, my assumption is, what kind of trauma in the broadest sense, not a physical orthopedic trauma, but what kind of input has been received to this immune and nervous system to make it feel more hypervigilant and at threat? And that means that you widen your field of saying what could be traumatizing to this nervous system. And you could take it as far back as adversity in childhood to adversity in present life in terms of domestic abuse or something in their psychosocial environment or in mental health, to actually something in their job or something that has happened to them in a previous hospital appointment where they have been not being told the right way. That itself is a traumatic experience if they've had an encounter with a healthcare professional that hasn't given them the right message or the right communication or the right words. So understanding that when they come to a pain clinic like mine or they come to any clinic, that people carry the sum total of a series of traumatizing experiences that they want us as healthcare professionals to support and reduce, that makes a big difference, I think, in then us thinking about how we want to approach our immediate environment. How do we change our immediate environment to be less traumatizing? How do we influence our communication and our language to be patient-centric and less traumatizing? What about our treatments? How do we talk about our treatments to be less traumatizing? How do we talk about our interventions to be less traumatizing? How do we talk about our aftercare and rehab to be less traumatizing? So everything is about bringing safety to the nervous and immune system that is at potential distress. And that's what I mean by a trauma-informed approach. And ultimately, all of this is downstream. We need to be asking for a human being to present themselves to a healthcare professional it's not about, by the time they've come to a healthcare professional, they have probably reached the edge of the waterfall or fallen down the waterfall. In a pain clinic, I'm often picking them up from the waterfall after they've fallen over. So going upstream, actually saying, what can we as a collective healthcare community do to prevent the patient from first falling into the river in the first place? And that's the upstream approach to say, well, how much further up? And that kind of, I think, aligns with what we do in lifestyle medicine, what we're doing in public health, what we talk about prevention, or what we should be doing about loneliness and everything that is coming into collective health discussions. But that, I think, the trauma-informed upstream approach broadens out the discussion to say that every time you're in a clinic, it's useful to approach with that frame of mind, because then in some ways I feel it reduces the angst I put upon myself to solve somebody's problem on that morning or afternoon. But it also means I can be more alive to the various bits in the system that I have probably influence in tweaking, or accepting that sometimes I can't tweak those. So what can I do that's less traumatizing to the person in front of me?
Well, the content of this book, I mean, it's an incredible resource for patients, but it's an incredible resource for clinicians. And I was just thinking about how I'm going to use it. And we only get such a short time in general practice, you know, 15 minutes. And that's patients come in with many problems. Chronic pain might just be one of them. But this book is absolute gold dust for me, because it's just something that I can recommend to people that we can work through. That is basically, it's Deepak in a book. It's like, it's a course, it's a toolkit. It's absolutely brilliant. And I was excited to hear on the grapevine that you might be doing an audio version. Is that right? Or can you tell us anything more about that?
It is. Thank you so much, first of all, Siobhan, for your kind words. It really means a lot to me on that front there. And two parts. One is, of course, for a lot of your listeners who are healthcare professionals who want to maybe take in information in a different way, I've managed to bring the book into a BSLM sort of course that's available on the BSLM website. And it's something that gives them the lifestyle medicine CPD points as well. But I'd like to think that I've put in that primer to using lifestyle principles in pain management. And that's one way to consume the content if they're not book readers. The other part, which a lot of my patients and healthcare professionals have asked me as well, and that's why I thought I would make it, is the audiobook. A lot of us consume this while in different ways, while going on a run or something there. And so the audiobook is going to come out in another 4 to 8 weeks. And I'm just sort of finished the narration. It's now going through the various whatever bits that audio engineers do to edit it. So it should be coming out in another. So if all your listeners can just log or look at some of the social media channels that I'm in, then I'll be putting up further details. It should be there by the end of March. And so thank you for that opportunity to plug that in now. Thank you.
No, that's brilliant. Well, I'm going to hand back to Sheena now, but we'll put all this information in the show notes at the end and add all this incredible resources and references that we've been talking about today.
Yeah, Deepak, this has been wonderful.
Likewise. Thank you so much for having me both. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Microbiomedics Podcast. We really hope you enjoyed the content and we welcome your feedback. We'd love to hear any suggestions you might have for microbiome topics that you'd like us to cover. And we also appreciate listeners' questions and we'll endeavour to answer them in the next podcast.